Next on the program, we are going to hear from Jasmine Christoph. Are you there on the line, Jasmine?
Yes, I am, Candace.
Okay, maybe first we can begin with an introduction. Who are you and why are you here on the show?
Well, I am a PhD candidate in the program of sociology at York University. And I have done a lot of research on the Colombian armed conflict, and also more generally in the fields of militarization, state violence, neoliberalism, and social movements in Latin America. So recently I published a book that came out from Ohio University Press in the United States and Between the Lines in Canada, and it's called Blood and Capital, the Paramilitarization of Colombia.
Great. And so what is your book about?
Well, the book examines the Colombian armed conflict by looking at issues such as poverty, inequality, human rights, violence, and revealing the mechanisms that generate these conditions. And in this process of looking at the mechanisms, there's one theme that comes up and goes through the whole book, and that is the issue of the use of violence in processes of capital accumulation, and how does that occur. Basically, that's the central and most important theme in the book. And I am presenting a new approach to conceiving the Colombian armed conflict, and that approach consists of accomplishing three objectives, basically. The first one is to visibilize the magnitude and the nature of human rights violations in Colombia by looking at the perpetrators, the victims, and the struggles by those who have been victimized. The second objective is to challenge the mainstream representations of the conflict, which can basically be described as two main kinds. The first kind is portraying the conflict as if it is one between the state versus the terrorists, which is the guerrilla in this case. And basically the state here is portrayed as trying to protect the population from the violence of these irrational, dangerous narco-guerrillas. The second kind of mainstream portrayal of the conflict is one where it is shown to be a result of a struggle between left-wing armed groups, the guerrilla, and right-wing armed groups, the paramilitary, with the state being this neutral third actor in the middle trying to contain the violence. And neither of these representations is accurate at all, and that's why I'm hoping to offer this new approach to understand the conflict. And the third objective that the book has is to complement and also fill in the gaps in what we can consider as progressive or leftist literature on Colombia, or that's been published within the last 15 years. And in that context, I'm trying to give more attention to local power dynamics and how local dominant groups use violence for processes of capital accumulation. And this helps us understand the huge displacement that is taking place, and the land inequality and so on. Because so far, even within the progressive literature, a lot of attention has been given to how United States, through its military and economic interventions, fuels the conflict, but not enough attention has been given to the local power dynamics. And this leads me to the last point which the book tries to accomplish, which is to give a good description of what really the paramilitary is. Because so far, there has been an inadequate conceptualization of the paramilitary. It has not been understood fully as a phenomenon on its own. So this is what I try to do in the book.
That's quite a challenge, I'm sure. I was wondering if you could expand on you know, this definition, maybe you could tell us, you know, what is a paramilitary?
Sure. Well, of course, I can give you a very complete overview in a short time. Basically, that's the task of the whole book, right? To do that. But just briefly, the paramilitary, we're talking about armed groups that are affiliated with the politically and economically dominant groups that have been carrying out human rights violations against members of the public, against civilians, who are thought to be in some way dangerous to the establishment. In other words, dangerous to those who are in power. And those categories of so-called enemies, or people that are considered to be targets, are very diverse. They range from left-wing politicians to leaders of social movements, such as peasant movements, indigenous movements, women, students, progressive academics, human rights lawyers, and so on. Also, people living in areas of strategic economic importance, such as areas of potential oil reserves, gas reserves. Also the homeless or those on the street who are targeted for social cleansing. So these are the different kinds of people that are targeted by paramilitary groups. And unfortunately, the state has been complicit throughout all these years since the 1960s when these groups were first created with the objective of helping the state combat left-wing guerrilla groups. And later on, there was another wave of paramilitary group creation, which was directed by the elite in the 1980s. And then these groups expanded, and grew in terms of financial and territorial power and military power and so on. And currently, they are said to have demobilized. But unfortunately, in reality, paramilitary activities still persist, although they are no longer regarded as paramilitary groups. So basically, these are groups who, with the complicity of the state and often with the collaboration of the state, have been carrying out activities against the kinds of social sectors that I mentioned.
I guess I'm curious where these paramilitary groups came from and how they operate, you know, who funds them, whose interests do they serve?
Okay, so they serve the interests of landowners, cattle ranchers, foreign companies, local companies, people in the emerald business, and drug traffickers. And, you asked how do they sustain? So these are their sources of funding, and they perform different kind of services for these groups. So these include protection from the guerrilla, also displacing people from areas that are considered of strategic, economic, and military importance, persecuting members of social movements who are considered to be a challenge or dangerous, and eliminating them. So in other words, this is the activities of the paramilitary demonstrate this single most important theme in the book, which is the use of violence for purposes of capital accumulation. And this is basically violence is used to displace and guarantee access to resources, to silence or to suppress all those that are considered as opposition, as dangerous, as challenging the system, as trying to construct a new society, and also those that are simply considered to be a nuisance or the garbage of society, the very poor people on the streets that are targeted for social cleansing.
And, well, I'm wondering who some of the actors are who enable these groups to operate.
Well, the actors range from, as I said, the owners of large companies, both local and foreign. So, for example, Coca-Cola, Chiquita Bananas, Drummond are all corporations that have been known to hire paramilitary forces. Also politicians, large landowners, those who own the African oil palm plantations and so on.
And I was wondering if you could maybe draw some connections between Canada and Colombia, maybe what Canada's role might be in the paramilitarization of the country.
Yeah, well, first of all, there are numerous connections between Canada and Colombia, and that's why it's important for Canadians to know more about Colombia. The first connection is the imports that we consume, right? Most of us consume bananas, coffee, flowers, and it's important to know under what conditions these products were handled. In other words, what is the climate in terms of labor rights and regulations that exist in Colombia? And perhaps here it's important to note that Colombia is the most dangerous country to be a union leader. And some of these workers who are operating on the banana plantations have been murdered by paramilitary groups. So that's, in other words, to look at what is the labor behind these products, right? That's one kind of connection. The other is that Canada is already, for some time, has been an investor in Colombia. There are a number of Canadian gas companies operating in that country, such as Kinross Gold. And these companies have had an impact on the living conditions of local rural communities. They have led to displacement, to human rights violations, and so on. And the third connection, which is the most current one, is the proposed free trade agreement with Colombia, which at the moment is awaiting ratification. It has been put on hold because there has been a considerable opposition in Parliament and also from the public in Canada. So it has been stalled, but it doesn't mean that it has been defeated. There has been a call for an independent human rights impact assessment. And the problem here is that really Canadians cannot rely on their government to inform them about the true situation in Colombia. Because if we judge from what Prime Minister Stephen Harper said in June of this year, I'm going to quote here, he said, "President Uribe and his government have made very important progress towards sustained peace, security, and protection of human rights in their country." Now, that's the end of the quote. Unfortunately, this statement is completely false. It is not a statement based on deep knowledge of Colombia. And therefore, it's important for people to read books such as the one I've written and other books that have come out recently on Colombia to find out more about really what is going on. And it is even necessary for politicians to inform themselves, because if they are going to sign this free trade agreement, it shouldn't be based on a lie that we're signing it because human rights violations in Colombia are being reduced and the government is doing a good job. It shouldn't be based on this lie. It should be signed only after the government is completely conscious of the real, very serious and upsetting political issues around Colombia, because it's not just about the economic consequences of signing such an agreement. It's also about Canada showing that it is willing to tolerate this kind of serious problems. So what are these problems that I'm talking about? Basically, they can be divided into external ones having to do with Colombia in the region, Colombia towards its other Latin American neighbors, and also internal ones, and they're equally serious. So, for example, if Canada signs this agreement, it would be signing an agreement with a country which, in March of 2008, violated the territorial and political sovereignty of another country, which is Ecuador, by invading it and launching an aerial bombing and land attack in which actually civilians died and were injured, right? Another very upsetting recent development is that Colombia is exporting paramilitary groups to Honduras since the military coup happened in Honduras. It has been allowing paramilitary groups to cross the border into Venezuela to make links with the existing opposition there, which tries to destabilize the Venezuelan government, and have been also carrying out human rights violations in Venezuela, in communities that are around the border area with Colombia. And also recently it was found out that members of the Colombian intelligence agency, DAS, were conducting undercover missions in Ecuador, Venezuela, and Cuba. So these are just some of the examples of serious political issues that Colombia is involved in. Now, internally speaking, within the country, to begin with, the Colombian armed forces are known to be one of the worst human rights violators in the world. And currently, hundreds of members of the military forces are being investigated for extrajudicial executions. So this is something that was known as the falsos positivos scandal in Colombia. The thing is that all these issues in Colombia appear as scandals, right? Mm-hmm. It's
yes,
like when the tip of the iceberg shows above the water, when the public hears about it, it's perceived as a scandal, something that just occurred. But in reality, these are issues that have deep roots and have been occurring for a long time. And they're embedded in that political economic structure.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it appears there are many implications to this potential ratification of the Canada-Colombia Free Trade Agreement. Jasmine Hristov, I would like to thank you very much for your time. Thank you for joining us here on News Now. I'm wondering if you have any final thoughts or comments you would like to share with our listeners as we wrap up.
Well, actually, the final points are what I wanted to say about now the economic impacts of the free trade agreement is that in reality it would be an extension of a colonial division of labor where Colombia is in a position of dependency on foreign markets and is focused on exporting primary resource-based exports. Where only agribusinesses and resource extraction companies benefit, while there is no internal industrial development. There would be further privatization of basic services such as water, sanitation, and health. There will be growth in maquilas, which we already know from the Mexican experience, the consequences that these have on people and on the environment. It is also in violation with the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People worldwide. It would also lead to more militarization and violence in the countryside, which is already happening. So all these things we need to be aware of and see how we can act as citizens and express our voices and our concerns rather than sit passively and just rely on the government to do its job, because perhaps the government needs to also be further educated and there needs to be more communication between the public's concerns and the government.
Great. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Jasmine Hristov, PhD candidate in sociology at York University, speaking about her new book titled Blood and Capital, The Paramilitarization of Colombia, which is out now on Ohio University Press and Between the Lines Press here in Toronto. You are listening to News Now, CHRY 105.5 FM.